Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 19th, 2006. Our session today is titled The Kangxi Emperor, The Growth of the Chinese Empire. Our presenter is Van J. Simons. Session number SYV 2006-1. Let's listen in.
To you before we start. My name is Van Simons. I'm a Qing historian. I work in 17th century Chinese history. Being at a small college, I teach the modern and formative East Asian courses. I work in modern Chinese history as well as Qing dynastic history. And for a period of time, I taught Russian and Soviet history as well. The last accreditation team that came through put an end to that. I was overextended. So I haven't taught the Russian history for quite some time, but I still have a great deal of interest in it. And I think as the week goes on and I work with people, what I hope to do is be able to make some comparisons between Kangxi as ruler and Peter the Great as ruler. They were contemporaries, along with Louis XIV, and all three of them are major figures in world history. Intriguingly, Peter and Kangxi had much in common, and not just borders as they came to be, as Kangxi pushes westward and Peter pushes eastward, but in their approach to governance and so on and so forth. I'm hoping that as we talk about Kangxi too, that we'll be able to recognize that there is such a thing as beneficent government, even in the context of autocracy. This was a dynastic government, a ruling house that ruled from 1644 to 1912. He was the third ruler of the Qing period. It was a conquest dynasty. They were Manchus who conquered China and imposed the rule on the Chinese people. But even in the context of that, I find in Kangxi much that's admirable about rulership, and I'll be reading passages from Kangxi's writing that suggests to us the concern he had as ruler and how he began to deal with some of the challenges he faced as a ruler. So I'm hoping to accomplish a lot with this one figure, dispel some myths, but really come to some of the key questions that I think a lot of Lutherans have, and that is, what defines just rulership and just government? I think that's a major concern to us. And I think he is this emperor was an embodiment of that. We'll focus some too on Kangxi and the Jesuits, because this is a Christian place, and the interaction he had with early Jesuits in China is really quite fascinating. Before I began talking about Kangxi, though, I'd like to kind of present to you some rationale for why I've taken this approach of dealing with five important figures in history. I know, as a historian, that there are a great many people that feel that history unfolds in deterministic fashion, that individuals don't play a great role in the shaping of history. And yet, I cannot imagine how the 20th century the course it might have taken had there not been, particularly the villains in history, a Hitler or a Stalin. A number of people come to mind. Mao Zedong, we'll be talking about him. Or people like Gandhi. I mean, I really do feel that there are political leaders, religious leaders in history that shape the very nature of history, some for the better and some not. And as we look at the five figures I choose to look at this week, what I want to do is set them in context and then examine the contributions of each of these figures to history. I'll do that with Kangxi and then tomorrow with Mao Zedong, and then we'll shift to Russia. And then having looked at their contributions, I hope to look at the consequence of their actions to judge them on the scales of history, for good or for ill, and then hopefully to make some comparisons, as I've suggested. It's going to be easy to compare Kangxi and Peter. It'll be easy to compare. They're both empire builders. The map that we were acquainted with up until the Soviet Union fell apart was very much shaped by Peter the Great. The map that we see of China today was very much shaped by Kangxi, clear back in the 17th century. And we have a lot in common for comparison there. I think we'll be able to do the same thing between Mao and Lenin. After all, these two experiences are the great revolutions of the 20th century and have shaped 20th century history in dramatic ways. I'm a Chinese historian. I find Mao a much more intriguing figure than Lenin, though I think Lenin shaped the Russian Revolution much more dramatically than Mao did the Chinese Revolution, though he would not be comfortable with me saying that. So we can compare these two figures. And then the last figure I want to talk about is Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet who emerges in early 19th century America. And I'm doing that because I happen to be LDS at a Lutheran camp. I've taught at Augustana College for 27 years. My wife and I have been enriched by the company of good Lutherans all those years. They've tolerated me, my faith, but many of them have come to me and asked me about it. And I sense that there are good Lutherans here who would like to come to terms, as best I might help you do so, with this figure who founded the faith that I'm part of. But from a historical context, we'll ask the same questions of Joseph Smith that we ask of these other figures. What is the context that he emerges in? What were his contributions as perceived by historians, but also by those of us that are members of that faith? What's been the consequence of his emergence? For me, it's 13 million of us are now members of this faith. And that's quite a pretty dramatic consequence. With each of these five figures, there are some wonderful texts that are available, and I'll introduce you to one solid text for each of these figures, including a recent biography that's just been written by a very fine historian out of Columbia University on Joseph Smith that I think is just a wonderful read. Maybe the first really good biography that's been done on this man. The text that I'm going to use today for this study of Kangxi is Emperor of China. It was a text written by Jonathan Spence, a scholar at Yale University. Recently, just last year, the president of the American Historical Association. He's must be 70 now. He's written a dozen different books. I suspect many of you are familiar with them. They're much more accessible than most history books about China. This was the third book that he wrote. And I was a graduate student at the time he wrote that, teaching at Connecticut College in New London, Connecticut. And he came to lecture at the college. And I made acquaintance with him at that lecture. And we've become lifelong friends since then. And he's nurtured my career to a certain extent. I'm particularly fond of this text, in part because I know well the writer. He is a very, very fine scholar. Let me begin by talking a little bit about Kangxi and who he was. I want to read quite a bit from this text to give you some sense of him. Kangxi was born in 1654. He was the third Manchu ruler to sit on the throne of China. The Manchus came out of the northeast, came out of an area northeast of China. It's now, we call it Manchuria. The Chinese call it their three eastern provinces. And overran China in 1644, much as the Mongols had overrun China a few centuries earlier. They imposed their rule on China. They avoided as best they could being Sinophite. They were about 3% of the populace of that empire when they controlled it. It's no small feat that they established a dynasty and reigned over China for 2.5 centuries, quite effectively, and managed to do so, though they were alien conquerors of China. The Mongols established the Yuan dynasty in China, lasted only a century, and then withdrew. So this is quite an achievement. And you'll see in Kang Xi some of the reasons for his success in doing so. He was born in 1654. He ascended the throne at the age of 7 years old. He was selected to be the ruler of China because if you look at this photo of him or this portrait, he had suffered from smallpox and survived. And much of the imperial family had been killed by a smallpox epidemic. And having survived smallpox, the regents that put him in power felt that there was a better chance that he would live through his reign than his brothers and sisters, his brothers. And so he was placed on the throne at 7. He was dominated for a period of time by powerful regents, Manchu tribal leaders, but by the age of 15, he's worked with an uncle to assume full power over China. So this was quite an incredible figure. And as we talk on Wednesday about Peter the Great, you'll find out that his story is very much the same. Peter emerges as a young man to assume power at a very young age. Kangxi ultimately had 30 consorts. Sired 56 children. By the time he died, he had 150 or so young descendants that replaced him. The idea was to have a number of consorts so you were assured of the long life of the dynasty. But that created its own problems because the children of various consorts vied one with another to rule in China. And that was one of the biggest headaches Kangxi had. I put on the board, let me read a kind of a passage to give you a sense of what it meant to be emperor of China in this context. And I'm drawing from Spence here in his introduction to this book. By acceding to office, the emperor became more than human. Or conversely, if he revealed human traits, those traits must accord with the accepted historiographical patterns of imperial behavior. In becoming emperor, Kangxi became the symbolic center of the known world, the mediator between heaven and earth, in Chinese terms, the son of heaven, who ruled the central country. Much of his life had to be spent in ritual activity, at court audiences in the Forbidden City, offering prayers at the Temple of Heaven, attending lectures by court scholars on the Confucian classics, performing sacrifices to his Manchu ancestors in the shamanic shrines. When he was not on his travels, he lived in the magnificent palaces in or near Beijing, surrounded by high walls and guarded by tens of thousands of troops. Almost every detail of this life emphasized his uniqueness and superiority to lesser mortals. He alone faced the south, while his ministers faced the north. He alone wrote in red, while they wrote in black. The ideographs of his boyhood personal name were taboo throughout the empire, while the ideographs of emperor were set apart from and above the lines of text in any document in which they occurred. His robes and hats had designs that no other person might wear. Before him, all subjects prostrated themselves in the ritual homage of the Kotel. And even the word which he used for I, Chen, could be used by no one else. Much of the story of this emperor is a story of a man who sat on the throne longer than any other ruler in China had ever sat on the throne, 61 years, and ruled surrounded by bureaucrats, dealing with the complexities of governance, but very much alone. And I guess anyone who's, if you've read the memoirs of great generals or great rulers, they'll tell you that it's a very lonely experience. And I'll read some from this book to give you a sense of the challenges faced by that as well. Let me go on. I hope I set context. Remember, I'm going to try to do four things: set context, and talk to you about what makes this figure. We call it, some historians, a hero in history, a person that really has left a legacy on historical development. That's what I'd like to do now: look at the contributions of Kangxi, and then I want to begin to consider the consequences of his rulership. And the nature of it, if I could. I've suggested to you that he emerges at very young age, ascends the throne in 1661. The dynasty had only been extant from 1644. So it's two decades that the Manchus have moved in and begun this consolidation of power over the Chinese people. At the time, there were about 150 million Chinese people. And so he's moved into a country that's well-developed, has its own system of government. And the Manchus very quickly determined that the way to effective rulership was to create a diarchic form of government. There were not enough literate Manchus to run the country, to collect taxes, to register land, to adjudicate disputes. The only way they could rule China was to rely upon Chinese court officials, or previous court officials, really, to help them in this process. So Kangxi had to persuade the Chinese, the old Ming Dynasty Chinese. The Ming Dynasty had been extant from 1333 to 1644 for three centuries, to persuade them to join a new alien dynasty in sustaining alien rule. And they were quite effective in doing that. But there's a lot involved in Kangxi's rulership that leaves us reason to admire him as a ruler. The first thing he had to do, I suggested here, he needed to complete the unification of China. Before the Manchus conquered China, China had fallen into a civil conflict. The Ming Dynasty was ineffectual. There was one Ming ruler, the second to the last Ming ruler, who simply withdrew to the court and paid no attention to rulership. He'd had disputes with scholar officials, mostly over his own personal life and the designation of a successor to himself. The court officials arguing that he properly should appoint one of his sons to be a successor. He had a new concubine he was particularly fond of, and he wanted to appoint their son to be ruler, and was chastened by the scholar officials for even considering such. And so he just set a pox on you and withdrew into the inner court and quit ruling, and cut the scholar officials, the bureaucrats of China, off from his own person, and insulated himself from them by relying upon eunuchs to manage the inner court. So that if you were a scholar official, you had to work through eunuchs to gain the ear of the emperor. And things just fell into chaos. Often dynasties went through this cycle of vibrancy and then decline. And so by the turn of the 1600s, the Ming Dynasty was clearly in decline. There was internal rebellion in China as officials became more and more manipulative and exploitative, as the government became less responsive to their needs. So there were a number of rebellions that arose, and that provided the context for the Manchus to overthrow China. Beijing, the capital of the Ming court, actually fell to a brigand who led an army into Beijing and conquered the capital. And the emperor, the last Ming emperor, hung himself when that occurred. And then a general on the frontier, who was really defending the frontier against the Manchus, found himself between the Manchus and a brigand that had just conquered the dynasty. His name was Wu. And he was faced now with a decision. Do I stay on the frontier and prevent the Manchus from coming in? Or do I turn back to Beijing, which was fairly close, and overthrow this brigand? Well, the brigand, in order to persuade Wu to side with him, seized Wu's family and his favorite concubine, which was a dumb thing to do. Wu got word that the brigand, in fact, had debauched his favorite concubine and turned open the gates to the Manchus and let him in. So the Manchus moved into China because China really had fragmented and fallen apart. A lot of great empires fall internally, don't they, before the, quote, barbarian overruns them. In this case, the Manchus would have been viewed as the barbarians. So they moved into Beijing, and one of Kangxi's most notable early achievements was to finalize the conquest of China. 1644, the capital falls, but by 1673, the south of China was still in the hands of Chinese people. There were three great generals that had moved to the south of China, and Kangxi, he was really young at the time, was counseled by his officials not to upset these three Chinese generals. But they were loyal to the Manchus. And the Kangxi Emperor determined that he would have to destroy those three generals and complete the unification of China. They were down in the Guangzhou area in the southwest part of China. And he began a war. This was, for him, the most troubling of all the battles he fought. Peter the Great spent most of his reign fighting wars. Kangxi spent most of his reign fighting wars too. And the first real big one was this War of the Three Feudatories. It lasted for 8 years. And like most civil wars, it was just devastating. The destruction was just untold. But finally he unified China. He forced those three generals into submission. And now the Manchus had come to control all of what is now China proper. That wouldn't include Tibet yet, wouldn't include the western parts of China, but he'd come into control of China. During that process, there were loyalists to the Ming court. The generals in the south had sided with the Manchus and then set up their own feudatories in the south. But there were Ming loyalists that had fled, and some of them to Taiwan. And the conflict between, over who controls Taiwan really has its origins back in this period, too. Ming loyalists had fled to Taiwan. Some of you may have heard of Kakshinga, who was a sea captain, but befriended some of the Ming loyalists, and that channel between Taiwan and China again served as a buffer. And Kangxi ultimately was able to claim Taiwan back into the realm of China. The next big challenge for him came the stabilization of the northern frontier. By now, Peter and the Russians have moved out into Siberia, and there's a contact zone up along the Ussuri River, and the Cossacks are coming in and building fortresses, and they're demanding tribute from the native peoples in the forests north of China. Those people had also been giving tribute to the Chinese, or they had been even before. And they're caught between a rock and a hard place. Who do you give tribute to? Both are demanding this of you. And Kangxi simply went up there. He had superior firepower. Went up and confronted the Russian armies at a place called Albizin, destroyed their fortress. They rebuilt it, destroyed it again, and finally reached the first treaty signed between the Chinese and a Western power, Russia at this time, based on terms of equality. And that was the Treaty of Nerchinsk, signed in 1689. And what it did was stabilize the frontier north of China for a period of time and allowed for an ecclesiastical mission to be established in Beijing, a Russian presence in Beijing. Because a number of Russians and people loyal to Russia had been captured during this fighting, And the Russians argued they needed a church to look out for their needs. That became a real problem to the British and the French and Europeans who came later, because the Russians had a church presence, a diplomatic presence in Beijing, and they did not. But he stabilized that northern frontier. Next, one of the reasons he signed an early treaty with Russia was because there was a threat posed to his realm in western China by a Dzongar Mongol, whose name was Galdan. The Mongols, remember, had been a presence north of China and west of China for centuries. And Kangxi was not unaware of that. And he launched a series of campaigns way out in the westernmost part of China, Chinese Turkestan, what is now Tajikistan, and out in the Tashkent area, to pursue Galdan. And it was a long and torturous struggle, because Galdan had all the mobility that the Manchu forces had. But Kangxi defeated Galdan and incorporated now for the first time that part of western China. Well, not for the first time, because it had been part of China as early as the time of Christ, but reincorporated that back into China. So the Chinese claim to Central Eurasia, or the Xinjiang area of Central Eurasia, the Silk Route area, dates back to Kangxi. At the same time, the Tibetans were fractionalized. There were two different sects of Tibetan Buddhism, the Yellow Hat and the Red Hat sects of Tibetan Buddhism. And one sect had particularly close ties through the Buddha, through the Mongol interest in living Buddhas. They had particularly close ties that were forming with the Mongols. And Kangxi was worried lest a Tibetan-Mongol unified front emerge that would undermine his control over Tibet and also the Mongols. So the Chinese claim to Tibet also dates from this period. You know, we often ask, well, do the Chinese have a justifiable claim to Tibet? And they'll say yes, because it's 1735. It was Kangxi's successor, but Kangxi starts the process, sent an army into Lhasa and occupied the capital. And they'll say that from 1735 on, the Chinese have controlled Tibet. So that's a 300-year, almost 300. That's bogus, by the way, but that's the claim that they'll make. Because there were long periods of time when the presence did not remain. But that's another contribution of Kangxi. You can see then that one of the reasons that those of us who study history regard Kangxi as a great hero in history, a great figure in history, is because he was the consolidator of Manchu power over China proper, Taiwan, Xinjiang, the western part of China, and Tibet. He gives order to this Chinese empire. Perhaps of more interest to us, though, is his relationship with the Jesuits, who he welcomes into China. The Catholic Church began to send Jesuit missionaries to China in the late Ming period. They went first to Japan. You probably know that story. Went first to Japan, discovered that Japan wasn't the center of the Asian, East Asian world, but China was. Left some Jesuits in Japan, but then the Jesuit missionary Xavier moves to China and begins that experience of the introduction of Christianity to China. These were fascinating individuals, brilliant fellows, who came very close as the Christians were to come, very close to converting significant numbers of Chinese people to the Christian faith. They did so by their technical skills. The Jesuits were very effective cartographers. astronomers, engineers. They had much of the science of the Western world that they could introduce to China. When they first arrived, the Ming emperors invited them to court and tested them. The court astronomers at the time were Muslim astronomers, and watching the skies was of particular importance to the Chinese, because that was a responsibility of Chinese rulers, to establish the calendar based on looking at the sky. Everyone knew, shortly to be an eclipse of the sun. And so a test was made, and the Jesuits were charged to best the Muslim astronomers in projecting exactly when that eclipse would occur. And they succeeded. And the Muslim astronomers were thrown out of court, the Jesuits invited in, and from that point on, the Jesuits had a significant role in Chinese politics, at least up through Kangxi, though he becomes somewhat disillusioned with them towards the end of his reign, and I want to explore that with you just in a bit. Let me set context here a little bit more. Kangxi is an interesting figure, as is Peter the Great, because they were eclectic in their approach to things. This is a young man who is just curious about everything. And if you study Peter the Great, you realize he was as well. Peter loved to build things with his hands. Kangxi delighted in everything imaginable. Here's what Spence says about Kangxi. Kangxi paid regular homage to the Confucianism and the Confucian classics. As he needed to, as a Manchu conqueror, he needed to pay lip service to the Chinese sensitivities. It amazes me that as a Manchu, who had a language entirely different than Chinese, Kangxi, he's only third generation in China, was erudite and effective in Chinese, but he still had this wonderful curiosity about other things. So Spence says, his outstanding trait was his exuberant curiosity, and he took endless delight in finding out what things were made of and how they worked. At different times in his life, he was interested in geometry, mechanics, astronomy, photography, optics, medicine, music, and algebra. He was patron to an extraordinary number of scholarly and encyclopedic projects in these and other fields. In his visit to the home and tomb of Confucius, we can see how the solemnity of the occasion in no way inhibited his desire for information. And in his conversation with the papal legate, we can observe him probing for precise information, even as his anger mounts. He was curious about everything, including the basic tenets of Christianity. And so the Jesuits were welcome. They served as cartographers. A fellow named Jartot mapped all of China based on Western cartographic methods. There were Jesuit physicians who attended Kangxi on his travels. There were Jesuit astronomers who served as officials in the calendrical bureau. Jesuit fathers like Verbeest and Thomas and Perea stood high in Kangxi's favor because they were unusually talented men who were willing to obey his orders. How many of you have been to Beijing? Okay, a few of you. When you were there, did you have the opportunity to go to the old Yunmingyun Gardens that were built for Kangxi, Yongzheng, and Qinlong, the two emperors that followed him? They, more than anything else, they're just to the west of the Forbidden City, but they, more than anything else, suggest the exuberance of Kangxi and his curiosity. You go to those gardens, they were destroyed, by the way, in the early 1860s as a reprisal by the British for a failed diplomacy at the end of the Second Opium War. The British went in, their engineers went in, they looted the Yunmingyun Gardens and blew them all up. And you can go and see the gardens. The Chinese have been smart enough not to rebuild them. They look like the Acropolis now. You can go into the gardens, and there are these old pillars that are laying against each other, and they look like Greek architecture. Kangxi and his grandson, Qianlong, invited the Jesuits to build them a garden. They had gardens that looked like the gardens of Hangzhou that were Chinese, but they had great pavilions that looked European in fashion. And this was the curiosity of these Chinese. They embraced this other culture, and the Jesuits then were engineers. They built the gardens, they got the water to flow through the lakes and everything. The Chinese could have done that, but they could not have built these Western structures. I'm really running out of time in a hurry, and I want to engage you in conversation, but I don't know how much you know about Kangxi, and the challenge I often face as a Chinese historian, Mao says this, that often people are a blank slate, and you can write on them, and that's good, because you don't have to clear off the slate of all the clutter before you write. But I don't know how much you know about Kangxi and where to start this dialogue. Let me set context maybe we can engage you in some discussion. And the discussion I'd like to engage you in is this dialogue with the Pope of Rome and this Christian experience in China, okay? The Jesuits were welcome through the Ming period, the latter part of the Ming period. This would be from the late 1500s to Kangxi's reign. So we're into the latter part of the 61st century. There were people at court that concubines particularly of Kangxi and Qianlong who listened to the gospel and accepted it. There were high officials at court who accepted Christianity. And the emperor looked the other way. It all began to break down, though, when the Pope sent a fellow named de Tournon to China to bring some order to what he viewed as growing chaos. Here is Kangxi's view on the Westerners, drawn from Spence. He says he welcomed the Jesuits. He realized that he could learn from them. They didn't seem much of a threat. The imperialists hadn't come yet. That happens with the British East India Company, and that's 1800s. We're clear back here in the 17th century. The Chinese people are confident, rightly so, of their presence. They're not too worried about them, but they are worried about Western Christianity to a certain extent. Here's what Kangxi says about the Westerners. But I was careful not to refer to these Westerners as great officials, and corrected Governor Liu when he referred to the Jesuits Regis and Fridelli, whom I had dispatched to make a geographical survey of his province, as if they were honored imperial commissioners. For even though some of the Western methods are different from our own, and may even be an improvement, there is little about them that is new. The principles of mathematics all derive from the Book of Changes, and the Western methods are Chinese in origins. This algebra, R Chubar, springs from an Eastern word. And he goes on and on. So he says, they came, they had something new, but nothing over what we already had. And he's right to a certain extent. Then he goes on, and I'm drawing a section from this. After all, they know only a fraction of what I know, and none of the Westerners is really conversant with Chinese literature. How bright can you be if you don't write and think Chinese? How sophisticated can you be if you're yet familiar with the Chinese classics? He says they weren't really conversant in Chinese literature. Often one can't keep from smiling when they start off on a discussion. How can they presume to talk about the great principles of China? Sometimes they act wrongly because they are not used to our ways. Sometimes they are misled by ignorant Chinese fellows. The papal legate de Tournon used wrongly elevated characters on his memorials, employed improper phrases, implied that the word emperor was also used among his own people, wrote his memorials on paper decorated with five-clawed dragons, and so on. Only the emperor could write memorials on five-clawed dragons. Who's this de Tornin fellow, you see? And so there's this chauvinism, this self-confidence, and the West has come. And now de Tornin was sent by the Pope to order things anew. And the issue really was a concern that the court had that Christianity was going to be answerable to Rome and not to the emperor. The issue was church and state. If the emperor of China, Kangxi, is the son of heaven, then anyone living in China is subject and answerable to him. But de Tornin had come because the Pope in Rome had begun to think that many of these Jesuits were becoming more Chinese than they were Roman. They were dressing in Chinese scholar official robes. They were being carried around in palanquins, much as the Chinese scholars were. They felt if they were to be respected in China, they had to play the role of Chinese scholar officials, Chinese mandarins, and they did. And the Pope was really worried about this. The real issue was the question of rights, and here's the issue. On the question of the Chinese rites that might be practiced by the Western missionaries, de Tornin would not speak, though I sent messages to him repeatedly. I had agreed with the formulation the Beijing fathers had drawn up in 1700, that Confucius was honored by the Chinese as a master, but his name was not invoked in prayer for the purpose of gaining happiness, rank, or wealth. So he's agreed with the West. Confucius is not a god. We'll let your Chinese converts recognize that Confucius is not a god. They can be a Chinese subject, they can be Christian, they don't need to burn incense to Confucius as a god. He's made that concession to the Westerners. Okay? That Confucian was honored by the Chinese as a master, but his name was not invoked in prayer for the purpose of gaining happiness, rank, or wealth. That worship of ancestors, which is a central core of Confucian faith, was an expression of love and filial remembrance, not intended to bring protection to the worshiper, and that there was no idea when an ancestral tablet was erected that the soul of an ancestor dwelt in that tablet. Okay? In Confucian ritual, what you do is, if you've seen a Confucian shrine, you have really the genealogy of the family on that shrine, going back to the founding figure in that clan. And incense is burned morning and evening, oblations are made, offerings are given, and what Kangxi had agreed is, what the Jesuits had agreed to is, this is not worship in the fullest sense. All this is paying reverence to your ancestors. Needn't worry about this. The Jesuits have agreed to that. And so Kangxi says, well then I'll accept Christianity. As long as you let our Confucians continue to pay respect to their ancestors, I'm fine. And when sacrifices were offered to heaven, it was not the blue existent sky that was addressed, but the Lord and Creator of all things. The Jesuits have made some concessions to Kangxi in order to gain access to the court. Confucians can be Christian, but can still burn incense to their ancestors. Confucius can be revered, but he's not a god. And that was the understanding. De Tornin comes in the middle of Kangxi's reign, and he says, well, Kangxi knows he's worried. And the Pope's going to begin to redefine what Christians must do if they're to be Christian, and that is distance himself further from Confucian rites. Okay. The other key was de Tornin came and he wished to have an emissary in Beijing, an emissary of the Pope. The only emissary in Beijing at the time from a Western nation was Russian because of the Treaty of Nerchinsk. And the Pope wasn't going to open that Pandora's box. So he says, no, I won't accept a papal legate. And then the other issue that came to fore in this moment was, if the emissary was to come, the Jesuits who had been 30, 40 years in China and had become very Chinese needed to reaffirm their commitment to Rome on a regular basis. And that's the church and state thing. If the Jesuits who are serving the court are in fact servants to Kangxi, their first allegiance must be to Kangxi and not to the Pope of Rome. And things broke down at that point. So there's that struggle between church and state. De Tournon came, made the requests. Kangxi said, I can't do this. What are you thinking? I'm the Son of Heaven. Your missionaries are here because I tolerate them. And their first allegiance has to be to me. And it's at that point that the relationship between Rome and China begins to break down. And it never really was repaired. Kangxi was more sympathetic to the Jesuits than was his successor, the Yongzheng Emperor, who had no interest in Christianity at all and was more philosophical in orientation, much more interested in Buddhist thought and Confucian thought than Kangxi was. And Qianlong finally made a break with the church entirely and began to persecute the church and limit its outreach. So that's kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? What would you do if you were emperor of China and the Pope began to rein in Chinese subjects who had converted to Christianity and defined their relationship to this Confucian scheme of things, which is the fabric of Chinese society. Any ideas? Kangxi right or wrong in this?
Interesting.
I'm just wondering how well informed the Pope was of the nature of the Chinese society.
I think the Pope was answerable to his Lord too, his God. I think very knowledgeable. The Jesuits corresponded with one another and with Rome and were accountable to Rome from the beginning. And some of our best understanding of China at this time is through the letters that were written by Jesuits in China. And many of them were focused on the nature of Chinese religion and how you work around these religious traditions of the Chinese and still introduce your own Christian tradition.
How big an impact are we talking about in terms of, I know you can't probably spit a number at me, but you know, a lot of the population, just a few people, how big was the Catholic presence in terms of converts?
Very, very small. But very, the Jesuits came to China hoping to convert China from the top down. If you could get a few key ministers to accept the faith, if you could convert the emperor, then all his subjects, by decree, would become Christian. In Japan, they had great success in that for a period of time until the Japanese, Japan was unified by the Tokugawa, and the church was viewed as a threat. And then the church, the shogun turned on the Christians and demanded that they recant their faith. And there were thousands of Japanese Christians who were martyred for their faith, and the missionaries were driven out. They made much more progress in Japan than in China. Japan, in part because when they got to Japan, Japan was in chaos. The Jesuits came and offered their expertise to the Japanese in a time of civil war, and would arm various claimants to power with guns and cannons, help them build fortifications. It was as military experts that the Jesuits gained leverage, and some daimyo converted to the faith. But once the state was unified in 1600, By 1640, the Christians were driven underground. In China, much less success, but more potential for success than occurred when the great Christian movement to convert China occurred, really beginning about 1800. And that came hand in hand with the traders, so that Christianity became inextricably linked with imperialism, which was terribly disadvantageous to Christianity. Often, in the name of promoting faith, and these were more Protestant than Catholic missionaries now, the Protestants were right in the forefront of encouraging change in China and aggressive action in China. So that when the communists take over, the Christians are driven out again. Did you have a comment?
My question, you called it chauvinism or confidence or whatever word you want to give it. Is there a legacy from that affects China's march into the world now in the global status it's going to have soon? Does that make sense, the question?
There's a legacy from this Christian experience in China that won't go away quickly. We need to realize that initially the court was favorable to the Christians, and mostly to Jesuits, because they were the only ones there at the time. But that with the first Opium War in China, there was a reversal of that. The Opium War was fought in China from 39 to 42, the first Opium War, and then there was a second Opium War. But it was fought really by the British, encouraged by the British East India Company, to ensure that opium could continue to be trafficked in China. Opium was the commodity that guaranteed the British East India Company profit in Asia. It was the difference between profit and no profit. It was the only good, the only goods that the British found that the Chinese needed. And so they actively transported and conveyed opium, grown in India, a British colony, to China, and introduced it to China. It was not a problem before the British came. And between 1800 and 1839, you have a growth from about, 4,000 chests of opium a year being trafficked in China to 40,000 chests. A tenfold increase in opium trafficking in China in 40 years. And it's estimated that between 4 to 12 million addicts had begun to smoke this drug. The Chinese tried to arrest this trafficking. They seized the opium in one trading year and destroyed it. That provided the pretext for the war. And when the war was ended, the Chinese, that had who had regarded themselves as the central kingdom and had every reason to be chauvinistic and self-confident and proud of their civilization, had been humbled by Western gunboats. And they never recovered. For the next century, from 1840 to 1949, China was simply exploited by Westerners. Extraterritoriality had been imposed on China. Westerners were not subject to Chinese law. Treaty ports existed in China all over China, that gave Westerners their own settlement areas with their own laws, with their own electricity, with their own police forces. And Chinese weren't welcome in those treaty port settlements. And that had to be just jarring to the Chinese people. Missionaries moved about China freely because the treaties guaranteed them that freedom to move. They were well-intentioned, and much of what they did was transforming of China. The schools for young women were first introduced to China in broad fashion by Westerners, because women did not have equal opportunities in education. a new jurisprudence system was introduced after the revolution in 1912 by the Westerners. Roads were built, communications developed. The social gospel was wonderful, but with that you still had missionaries that were challenging traditional values that were held dear by a lot of people. And somehow the Christian converts got mixed up with the imperialism that infiltrated China at the same time. And there was little hope that after the communists seized power, the Christians would have any opportunity to remain in China. And they're still not there today. One would have hoped that this Jesuit experience might have worked, but it didn't. In part because you had two infallible individuals, answerable to heaven or to God, worried about their flocks, and unable to communicate one with another. It's a fascinating thing to read about and discover. That conflict between church and state in this sense was just jarring. Let me conclude. We've got four more minutes, and then we've got to get to supper. I want to give you as fine a picture of this last emperor as I can before we break. This is the valedictory he wrote just before he died. Over 4,350 years have passed from the first year of the Yellow Emperor to the present, and over 300 emperors are listed to have reigned, though the data from the three dynasties, that is, for the period before the Qin burning of the books, are not wholly creditable. Well, anyway, he goes on to say, "What man am I that among all those who have reigned long since the Qin and Han dynasties, it should be I who have reigned the longest? You rule longer than anyone else. I am already old and have reigned long, and I cannot foretell what posterity will think of me. Besides which, because of what is going on now, I cannot hold back my tears of bitterness, and so I have prepared these notes to make my own record." He was dying, and there was no clear successor as to who would follow him, and he was worried about whether all his diligence would pay off in the end. He goes on to say, "Those among the rulers of earlier dynasties who did not live long have all been judged in the histories as having caused this themselves through their own wild excesses, by over-addiction to drink and sex. Such remarks are just the sneers of pedants who have to find some blemishes in even the purest and most perfect of rulers. I exonerate these earlier rulers because the affairs of the country are so troublesome that one can't help getting exhausted." Chu Gualiang said, "I shall bow down in service and wear myself out until death comes." But among all the officials, only Chu Gualiang acted in this way. "Whereas the emperor's responsibilities are terribly heavy, there is no way he can evade them. How can this be compared with being an official? If an official wants to serve, then he serves. If he wants to stop, then he stops. When he grows old, he resigns and returns home to look after his sons and play with his grandsons. He still has a chance to relax and enjoy himself, whereas the ruler in all his hard-working life finds no place to rest." He talks about having ruled, you see, for 61 years. He began his rulership at the age of 15. He dies as ruler. He's no longer serving. I mean, there's no one serving him in his old age that had begun his career with Kangxi. And as you read this text, you find he was incredibly attentive to the affairs of state. He would review all capital punishments before a person could be executed in the whole state of China. And he writes in the margins. I mean, it was a very effective judicial system. And you'll see in his vermilion brush, he'd say, "Poor calligraphy here, what are you thinking? This doesn't seem to be a valid case, and then he would reprieve them. Any capital crime in China had to be reviewed by the emperor before the execution occurred in the autumn. And so he had the burden of that, the burden of a diarchic government, the burden of running an examination system, the burden of running a state of 150 million people, and then conducting all these campaigns. I'm just intrigued by this man who seems to have been of good heart, to have accepted the mantle of rulership as good rulers do, who would be a good model, I think, for some of the rulers of the world today. What I'm saying in the end is, we often, as Americans, presuppose that the only government that can be valid is a democracy. And I'm not sure that people have always been that well served by democracies. And I'm not sure that people have always been that ill served by non-democratic governments, particularly if it's a crowded country of 150 million people, now 1.3 billion people, living in an area the size of America that's less geographically blessed. I think we need to be cautious in presupposing that what works for us necessarily works for someone else. And I hope to explore this theme a little bit more as we go through Russia and so on and so forth. I've appreciated your attendance. With Mao, you'll know more about Mao Zedong tomorrow, and we can throw it open more to the